Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Science Studio program. Today we're going to be talking math, numbers. Do we need to know numbers precisely? Can we know them generally? Is there a difference? How do we educate people to enjoy math? How do we educate people to be functional with mathematics? I know none of this, so we've got a guest today from Stanford University. Her name is Professor Jo Bowler. She's in the Department of Educational Mathematics, or she's in the Department of Mathematical Education.
The Graduate School of Education.
She's in the Graduate School of Education at Stanford and is making quite a splash by trying to tell the world, if they listen, and millions are apparently, about a better way to think about numbers, a better way to teach math. So, Jo, welcome very much to Science Studio.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into your ideas and other people's ideas about improving the way we expose our children, because that's where we're talking about, the earliest levels of education, to better theories, better approaches to math, I'd like the people to know a little bit about Jo.
Okay.
You know, why are you a professor in this area? How'd you get there?
Good question. Well, I actually started, in my studies, I took a degree in psychology at the University of Liverpool. And my plan was to become a child psychologist, for which you are required to teach for a little bit. So I decided to teach maths and got fascinated by the teaching and learning of maths. So I then decided to do more mathematics study. I took a degree with the Open University and then a master's and a PhD. But I found kids or anybody's learning and the processes they go through while they're learning really interesting. So I decided to sort of stay in that field of mathematics education.
What was it that really twigged you into being interested in that?
I mean,
I can see because you had to teach as part of this, that got you into the educational part. And math, you just had a natural enjoyment.
Well, I always enjoyed maths.
Right.
It was my best subject at school. I was pretty interested in the learning of it even when I was in school. I remember when I was, you know, 15 or 16, my friends used to get me to help them with maths. And I realized at the time that the teacher was not very helpful. And we, all of us, just stopped asking the teacher for help. So I ended up helping others. And I remember thinking at the time, why isn't the teacher better at teaching this?
Did you ever later on question this person?
No.
Male, female?
Well, the particularly bad one I'm thinking of was a man. And he was the head of maths at the school. And I remember when he started teaching us, he said, if anybody has any questions, just ask me. So, you know, a couple of weeks in, I asked a question. And I remember it really clearly. He said, you have a question about that? Like, it was the worst thing ever. And I was like, okay, I'm not asking a question again. That was my end of asking questions of that teacher. But I did have an amazing, one amazing teacher that stands out for me, a woman, when I was doing A-level maths. So I was about 17. And
yeah, let me just interject here that Jo's talking about growing up in England. She hasn't mentioned that. Whereabouts were you, in fact, literally?
Near Birmingham, in
near
the
Birmingham,
center,
right
of,
in the middle,
the center
right?
of the country.
And so yeah. A levels, O levels, they're sort of examinations you take at 16 and 18.
Yeah.
And if you do well at 18, you have the possibility of going on to the university.
That's
so
right.
This is where we are. And of course, when you were 16, 17, and 18, you were only studying a very limited number of subjects.
So when you're six, at the time when you were 16, you get to choose maybe three or four subjects.
All right. Or you have them chosen for you, as I did. My parents and the teachers conspired against my wishes.
That's not good.
But that's another story.
Well, I chose to take maths. And I had a great teacher, Mrs. Marshall. And what was so amazing about Mrs. Marshall was she would let us talk about maths questions. And she would give these questions out to us. And we would sit and discuss them and think about different approaches and think about why they worked. And that just changed the whole of maths for me. I didn't see it the same after that. I guess after I went through my psychology degree and I decided to teach maths, and I went to the University of London and did a teaching credential for a year, I was already really thinking about the possibility of teaching it differently and giving people different experiences.
Okay, so I mean, this is a formative. And then now you are in Stanford,
mm-hmm.
and what is it that you do in this particular region? What are you trying to sort of educate, if you like, the teaching community of mm-hmm. math and science in general? Mm-hmm, what's the particular angle?
Well, most maths teaching is not very satisfying or enjoying for people. We have a nation of maths traumatized people, and I like to think and say that pretty much everything in the teaching of maths is the opposite of what it should be.
Ah, well, there we are. So there's lots to work at.
There's a lot to work at, yes.
Poke your finger into the teaching curriculum and uh-huh. pull it out and
yes.
go for
I
it.
I teach a class actually at Stanford called How to Learn Maths to undergrads. And I remember one of the young men taking it last year said, oh, I came into this class thinking about I would learn about ways to tweak education. And now I've realized we just need to start all over again. Like, there's really nothing to keep.
Well, that's interesting. So, I mean, the place, there are many people, I don't know if I'm one of them, but I suspect I could be, that says, look, why do we need so many people studying education?
Mm.
Why not have people study the subject more?
Mm.
The chemistry, the physics, mm-hmm. the biology, the history, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then let them go away for a year maybe to get some credential.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the way it works. We've got these enormous big departments, colleges of education, putting out hundreds and hundreds of people, whereas only scores of people getting mm-hmm. degrees in some of the disciplines.
Mm.
Is this some aspect of the way you would think, or you don't go quite that far?
Well, I don't know that system, actually. In California, the way we teach teachers is they do a degree in their subject, maths, and then they do a year of education.
Oh, really?
Which is what I did as well, that
yes.
kind of approach. So not everywhere uses that, but
well,
I mean,
that's interesting. Why is California ahead of the game, as far as I'm concerned? Why do they insist on getting a degree first and then pick up credentials later?
I don't know how that's evolved differently in different states and different places. I'm not sure. I would say, though, that there is a lot to learn about the teaching of subjects.
Yes.
And people think, oh, well, I've, you know, I know my subject really well. I can just go out and teach. I'll be a good teacher.
Well, I know that's not true.
Actually,
I've had experiences.
Not true. And
right.
So I am an advocate for people spending a lot of time really thinking about, and not just how to teach, but how to teach their subject. Lee Shulman is a professor, now retired from Stanford, who taught the world about this type of knowledge that teachers have that other people don't have, which he calls pedagogical content knowledge. So for maths, for example, it's this pedagogical content knowledge is, it's not just knowing maths, but how do you represent it in a way that other people can learn it? What kind of visuals do you use? What kind of, how do you handle it if somebody has an incorrect idea? This is a type of knowledge that people need to teach.
So the concept of visual
yes.
and math
mm.
don't necessarily go together.
Well,
right?
They do for me. But
they do for you. So, but the thing is, I was thinking I've done had lots of conversations with physicists who will wax on about quantum entanglement
mm-hmm.
and string theory. But they never draw pictures for me. I mean, it's purely that's where the math has taken
mm-hmm.
them.
Which is unfortunate. And I work a lot with neuroscientists at Stanford. And one of the interesting things they're finding is every time your brain is thinking about maths, there are actually five different brain pathways that are engaged. And two of them are visual pathways. And so your brain really wants to think visually about maths. And what's really fantastic is if you think in different ways. So if you see something numerically, but you see the visual equivalent of that, that will cause your brain to start making connections across brain areas.
Can you give the audience an example of some mathematical piece of information and then
mm-hmm.
put it into how you visualize that?
Yeah, I mean, everything in maths can be taught visually. And in the talks I'm giving later here, we're going to look at visual algebra. That's one of my favorite things to make visual. But we could think about, for example, one of my favorite questions, 18 times 5. So if you think about 18 times 5 and how you solve that question, a lot of people in the States who've grown up in the school system will line those numbers up in their head and carry in their mind But actually, you can think about 18 times 5 in lots of ways. And one of my ways of thinking about it is 18 times 5 is the same as 9 times 10. Well, I could give you a visual of that, which would show you 18 times 5, say, as a rectangle. And we could look at what 9 times 10 looks like, also as a rectangle. We'll see they have the same area, which is part of why they give you the same answer. So in our teaching of kids, we'd have them both looking at visuals as well as the numbers and having those great
connections.
So there's
a lot of graphical display is what you mean by visual.
Visuals, yeah.
And so having areas in this particular case.
In this case, it could be area, yeah. But I think all maths can be represented visually. And what's really nice is if kids come up with their own visuals that are important to them. Not a teacher saying, oh, here are the numbers, here are the visuals. But let's ask the kids, how would you visually represent that and have
so
a discussion about that?
I know you have a website, and at the end of the program we'll get to it. But do you have examples on the website with the children or the students' visualization? And do they vary very much?
Definitely. And we find, actually, that because most teachers in the U.S. have grown up in the American system and they haven't thought about maths visually, a lot of teachers find it hard. They can't even think of a visual. And we've noticed country differences. When we went to England recently and we asked teachers to think visually about this question, a whole room of hundreds of teachers sketched three different visuals. But when we ask the same question here, people just
look
at us.
Three different visuals for one question.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, but when we ask the questions here, people just say, I have no idea how to represent that visually. So, for example, 1 divided by 2/3. You ask that question, and some people can work it out by doing some numerical manipulation and cross-multiplying. But what's really interesting is to prove the answer visually. How do you prove the answer to 1 divided by 2/3 as a visual? And so we ask people to do that. And as I said, very frequently here, people just say, you know, they just come up blank. They don't know. So they haven't exercised those visual parts of their brain.
Right. So, I mean, for me, it would simply be 3/2. All right.
Right. So you flipped it. And
yeah, right. But I wasn't thinking visually.
Right.
I suppose I was. That's interesting because I'm actually looking at the fraction.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But that's I'm not sure if that's visual or
well,
not.
Flipping it, we're taught to do, is so meaningless for people. They have no idea why that works.
Okay.
It's just something I remember. You have to flip it, which is part of what makes kids think maths is kind of meaningless.
I mean, you stimulated me. I teach a class every Monday. It's a seminar class. 16 students, all of whom are scientists of one type or another, and they're all expected to go on to PhD programs when they graduate. But I'm going to try this experiment, and I'll look up this website, which we'll name later, to try it because it appeals to me.
Ask them if they can prove 1 divided by 2/3 visually.
Okay.
See what happens.
I'll see. How many people do? You know, if you take a 100 students in the U.S., 18-year-olds, sophisticated enough to know what the question is. How many people will do it satisfactorily?
Probably less than 20%.
20%.
I had a little article showing 1 divided by 2/3 visually. I remember that was in the papers a year or so ago. And all the comments underneath it were so amusing to me. And people saying, did you see that? Like that visual of, it was just mind-blowing for people.
So it's got to have a whole different attitude to teaching, which is what I presume is the thrust of your career.
Yeah, well, and we're really spreading on our website that maths can be not only visual, but beautiful and creative.
Oh, well, yes.
And that is what helps teachers so much, because many teachers in our system have grown up thinking maths is just rules. And so when they see this creative visual maths, they're really quite excited by it.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. Our guest is Joe Bowler from Stanford University, and we're talking about visual math. So think about that while you listen to this intercession in our program. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Joe Bowler from Stanford University, and this concept of visual math. So you would need, though, to revolutionize the way math is taught from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, times tables. I must have done, well, I mm-hmm. did. I mean, everybody did. You did too.
Yeah.
I mean, and I just remembered them. And yeah. I got to 13, it became more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
12
mm-hmm.
times 12, 144, and then no more. Okay?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So would that still be part of teaching math? I mean, there's a certain amount of rote that, in a sense, is essential.
I would say that that approach, which I would call blind memorization, here's
right.
a set of tables, just memorize them, is the least effective way of knowing times tables. So, I mean, you can remember maths facts. That's kind of useful. But remembering them by doing meaningful things with the numbers is much better than saying just blindly memorize them. Don't think about it.
I assumed, and I can't remember it so long ago, that, okay, there was the rote to learning the times tables, but then there was all sorts of examples that you had to solve.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's
mm-hmm.
not just that mm-hmm. was it, and then you're off on your own.
The trouble is, though, when we start in the US, there's a big emphasis on memorizing times tables, and along with that, tests, speed tests.
Ah.
Many teachers think the way to know your times tables is to do well on this speed test. So this is what starts maths anxiety, particularly for deep, slow thinkers. They don't feel they can just whiz through at speed, reproducing information. So not only does it begin maths anxiety for people, but it starts people thinking, oh, because such emphasis is given on it, they start to think, oh, that's what maths is. It's the fast, shallow recall.
So it's the facile nature of it that they're trying to get to without a deeper sort of understanding that translates into all sorts of other regions.
And it's really off-putting for people. And so we have a paper on our website that's called Fluency Without Fear. And in that paper, it describes why we don't want to do things like time tests. And then it shares all these great ways for kids to learn maths facts where they're playing games or they're seeing things visually or they're... So they're learning the maths facts, but they also understand those maths facts, and that means they can use them in different situations.
Do you think there's a virtue in adults going to your website?
Yes.
Because, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to get at there mm-hmm. is that bad habits die hard, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So if you've grown up doing the 18 times 5,
right.
5 eighths of 40,
yeah.
put down the zero, carry 5, add to 8 or whatever it was, and you come up with the answer. You think that an adult in their mid-30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, wherever, can appreciate a different way of doing it.
Absolutely,
by going
yeah.
to... So,
I mean, coming to the website can give them a little beginning. I have a book as well called Mathematical Mindsets. It's another way to get the ideas.
I just add here that Joe's not on a book tour here, but never mind.
But... Yeah, the website. But what I most would like is people to come to one of our workshops. Because really, every adult should have a good relationship with maths.
Mm-hmm.
And many adults are going to be parents, so really important to have a good relationship with maths. And we have people come to our two-day workshops who hate maths and come out of it just seeing maths totally differently.
That's excellent. Are you going to franchise this? I mean, there's only a limited amount of time for Joe.
I know. That's what, so we have online classes that are another way to get this information. And they've been taken by over 250,000 people. So people actually take these classes. And again, they come out going, oh, my gosh.
Are they just in English or could they do it around here?
We have.
In Spanish, for example?
We have the most popular online class, which is really for learners, is in English and in Spanish.
Okay. And you've found you're getting a lot of success.
Yeah, people are really interested.
Well, you've mentioned many things, but I want to go to this area which I wasn't expecting to talk about, and that is, in a sense, neuroscience. You've got quite a bit of experience. You're collaborating with people.
Mm-hmm.
Which regions of the brain do what? Are there parts of the brain that sort of atrophy at the same time?
Atrophy is
a big word, but you can see variations, uh-huh. positives and negatives.
What they know about the brain now is the brain cells that stay and the brain connections that stay are the ones you use.
All right.
So you can learn something but never use it again, never go to it again, and it's probably going to – then it probably will atrophy, as you say, or just gradually fade away in the brain. And so
it's like pathways in England. If you don't have these these people that insist on doing the public pathway week after week, once a week, just to prove the fact that's a public pathway.
Oh, yeah.
Same with the circuits
that's
in the brain.
Similar, yeah. And talking of England, I mean, the whole neuroscience world was completely rocked by a study that was done in England of London black cab drivers. So that was the beginning of neuroplasticity, because the brain scientists realized that these black cab drivers have to learn hundreds of thousands of streets and routes around London. And they have to learn every route within 25 miles of central London. And they realized they were going through a very complex geographical mathematical exercise. So they looked in the brains of black cab drivers, and one,
while they were driving.
So they do before and after, kind of before they went through this complex training, which is called the knowledge.
The knowledge, right.
And afterwards. And what they found was significant brain change. Their hippocampus had grown significantly. So this was shocking to the world, because not only were they seeing this brain change in people, but in adults. And so
in a relatively short space of time. That's the key.
And then they found that when people retire from being a black cab driver, those brain areas shrink down.
Right.
So you have to keep using them. It's not because they were older.
But they are transferable. I mean, in the sense, okay, the knowledge gets lost, but then they pick up literature or they pick up math or some other thing. It's not like it's atrophy. It's just being reused.
It's just, what are you using? They're probably using something else more. And some of the studies of brain growth have been done in retirement homes, and they find that the people whose brains grow the most are the ones who take on an activity that's new to them. Yeah, you need to keep using a brain area to keep it going. And they do. There is this notion of competitive brain space. You can't be an expert in everything, because your brain just can't take on everything. And so when you become an expert in one area, that's the area that your brain is going to be really focusing on.
This is called competitive brain space.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting expression. So, I mean, it's pretty much assumed that this is correct now. I mean, this is an accepted hypothesis and been proven.
Yeah.
Interesting.
The neuroscientists have a lot of evidence now. And one of the things I find amazing that I like to share with people is they have found that when people do number calculations, an area of the brain lights up that is seeing fingers. And so they've studied
let me get this straight. If you look at the image, like magnetic resonance imaging, well, it's actually the process. You see fingers of connectivity.
There's two areas of the brain concerned with fingers. One lights up when you're using your fingers. And the other lights up, and they call it this finger area of the brain. Now, I don't know exactly how this works, but this is what they know. That when you develop your finger perception, which is knowing your fingers really well, your maths achievement increases. So a test for finger perception is to put your hand under a table or a book and have somebody touch your fingertips and to see if you can say which fingertips are being touched.
And there are people who can't do that?
Well, little children can't do it.
But once you know where your fingers are.
But even adults. So the amount of finger perception college students have predicts their scores on calculation tests. So there are differences even as adults.
This is great. So I know people are getting rid of the GRE, which actually I'm not so happy about, but it doesn't matter. But maybe they'll substitute the finger test.
Maybe.
All right, you just go in, put on a blindfold. We'll try this after the program. you can try me, but I don't want to do it on the air. Well, this is fascinating.
And this is now why they think musicians have higher maths achievement, which is something they've always known.
Right.
There's some link between maths achievement and music.
I remember many years ago, a fellow came to my office and said he wanted to do a postdoc. And I had money, but I wasn't looking for a postdoc. I didn't want one at that time. And so I pointed this out. Then after a conversation and a cup of coffee, it turns out he was a cellist in the local symphony. Mm. And I changed my mind completely. That was enough.
Yeah.
Because it's not just a matter of what you're saying, but it's also the discipline.
Right.
That someone who's really that good is really an asset.
Rare. You have to be very disciplined. But yes, so lots of surprising things are coming out of neuroscience and really important for all of us to know,
so,
I think.
So you must have a goal. You know, you've got this website. You're reaching millions of people.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a surprise to you? I mean,
yes.
You look back. I mean, you're not that old, you know. And so you look back and think, here I was growing up in Birmingham, and then I went to Liverpool. And you went from a rather poor footballing area to a very good footballing area. But here you are, one of the premium universities in the world, and with this tremendous website and following, with a new paradigm. Now, was it just you? Or, I mean, who were the first people to come up with this whole approach?
Not just me, no. And one of the things that caused me to start doing more of this outreach work is because the whole maths education community is pretty much on the same understanding of knowing we're teaching maths wrong. But that hasn't impacted schools. And I thought, why do we just keep doing more and more research looking at good maths approaches if the schools are nowhere near that? So I turned my attention a bit.
That's interesting because you're going off on a tangent. It's a little dendrite out there.
Yeah.
And so there's no one up there with you to bring
there's
it
no
on.
There's no point in all these academics reading each other's work.
Ivory towers. I mean, they're wonderful in many, many ways. I wouldn't do anything other. We've got just one more minute. So what I want to do is for you to say very slowly the website where our listeners can go and practice their skills and learn a different approach.
Yes, our website is called U-Cubed, and it's youcubed.org. The idea is it's you to higher dimensions.
Lovely.
U-Cubed.
Who came up with that? Is that your idea?
Actually, the name of it came up during a dinner with a poet called Julie Lithcott-Haynes, and she and I were trying to think of names for our website, and somehow we came up with it that night.
And I mean, and that brings up a whole different program, the need for interaction between scientists and people who are not trained as scientists.
Yeah.
With a whole different vision, different vista.
Absolutely.
I mean, in a sense, it's going back to teaching math in a different way.
Yeah.
We ought to teach science in a slightly different way.
Yeah.
So we get more people in the arts and music in with us.
Yes, I agree.
I think we've got to stop. Sam Cassiano, the producer, is telling me to cease. And so Joe Bowler from Stanford University, new math approach. Thank you very much for being here.
Yes,
it's a lot of fun.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for chatting.
And so thank you for listening out there. And we'll be back next week with something totally different. Talk to you later.